Welcome to the For the Reef podcast. Each week we bring our fish nerd conversations from the fish room floor to your living room. We try to bridge the gap between the saltwater aquarium hobby and coral reef conservation. Now, here are your hosts, fisheries biologist and founder of For the Reef Apparel, Mitch Dender, with local fish store owner and first responder, Ian Bell.
All right.
Mr. Aaron Hunt, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
So today we got Aaron Hunt back from the Cayman Eco Divers. We've been saying we wanted to do it for a while, and here he is. So we're looking for some updates, and of course, it's always fun to chat with you because you're passionate, energetic, and a hilarious guy.
Well, it has been a wonderful year full of whimsy and joy and just unicorn kisses from one end to the other. And despite all the challenges that we faced here since last time I got to speak with you all, we have a surprising amount of successes and some real home run type victories that we're extremely happy about, especially when you consider just how well the last year has been going. Making progress like we are is just, we're ecstatic.
We were pretty concerned for you there for a while. I thought that hurricane was going to form right on top of you.
Ida did form directly on top of us. The problem is that when they form like that, the center is essentially the eye of a hurricane. So while I had to cancel our night dive events that were supposed to take place that night as Ida formed directly on top of us, it was the eye of a hurricane. It was dead,
right,
flat, calm outside. And then as it pushed north of us, it formed more cohesively over the water and then pulled waves back in after it. So the next day we couldn't dive. And it wasn't until 2 days later that we were able to get back in the water for our coral nursery spawning dives. I was absolutely beside myself thinking that the night Ida formed on top of us was the night that it was supposed to be the spawning in our nursery, and right, that I had missed it and couldn't even go back the day after to verify because of how bad the water conditions were. But the night Ida formed, it was beautiful, like absolute, just still everything, flat water. We canceled it because of the safety issue, but right, looking outside, I just kicking myself.
Yeah.
And part of that was because Tropical Storm Grace hit us a week previous, and we had winds in excess of 100 miles an hour. They were not sustained winds like throughout the course of the entire event, but it was about the worst storm that I've been on island for when we got hit. I've still got trees down in the yard. There's still damage done to the building here. And everywhere you look, there's still tree branches and telephone lines, and it hit the island hard and really put some of that fear of the power of a storm and what a hurricane really could mean into everybody, and not the least of which myself. I didn't want to be making any foolhardy decisions by sending people in knowing that Ida was forming this soon after, potentially right on top of us, with every chance to be as destructive as Grace had been the week before. So it was with a very heavy heart that we did drag things out. But two nights later, me and my wife, Brittany, went in to check the Sunset House nursery. We swam out to the nursery site. And as we were doing a fragmentation of some of the pieces to look at the interior of them for any signs of gametes, and also, Curse, I got to wear glasses. So I probably need to get those prescription lenses in my mask because I'm out there with the magnifying glass looking at it with the flashlight. She starts poking me in the top of the head and I hear her screaming. So either something terrible or something amazing had happened. As I look up, they're just going off.
And
I guess the gametes were still there, camera on, and we got some really nice video of the coral spawning there at the Sunset Nursery.
So what were you looking for? You were breaking. So when you're saying you were magnifying in, you were looking for gametes inside the coral, or do you mean, and then you noticed that they were already spawning around you?
Literally while I'm face into the coral with a flashlight and a magnifying glass trying to look at this thing to identify the little gamete bundles that form inside of each one of the coral polyps, she starts bopping me on the head and shaking me, kind of And right. Sure enough, the corals are starting to spawn right in front of us.
Because it's dark, right?
Well, not just because it's dark, but because we do time our dives to pretty much go in right around the photo period time requirement for the corals to trigger that spawning reaction.
Okay.
All corals are if they live in sunlight, they have some relationship with the sun, and the spawning events are based on how many minutes past sunset on a given day. So if it's 90 minutes after sunset, and statistically every year the coral spawns somewhere in about a 5-minute category, 90 minutes after sunset, you can pretty much expect next year.
Yeah,
start over.
We're just going to.
We can
it.
Predict when the corals are going to spawn by a number of minutes after sunset. Historically, every previous year, within about a 5-minute, maybe 10-minute window. And we can project what time we should be in the water for that particular species. The Acropora species, the staghorn, the elkhorn, the fusillara, they tend to be a little bit less predictable on what given day, but we can still dial it down either to they're going to spawn pretty much every day or a little bit every day for 2 weeks, or it'll be on one of these 3 to 5 days after the full moon. Just have to be in the water at that certain time on each one of those days to be able to monitor for that. Whereas the coral spawning activity that we just went and did last weekend dealt with all the different types of star coral, most of the brain corals, all the different reef building corals that aren't acroporas. And for most of those, it was down to a single day, and it was at different times throughout that day, starting about 6:30 and ending about 1 a.m. If you were in the water, just look around. It was like fireworks going off. It was much easier to dial in that specific date and to dial in a specific time for what species you're trying to get access to.
Okay, so the corals are spawning now, and you guys are down there. What do you do from that point?
Honestly, we are just recording the fact that it's happening. We are documenting what species. We contribute on a couple of different social media groups that are gathering data about spawning activity throughout the Caribbean so that it helps build more solid future models for predicting when spawning activity will go on. But outside of that, the very act that the corals did spawn is really the end goal we have for any corals that we have out on the reef or in any of our nursery environments. In the upcoming couple of weeks, we are going to be doing a series of reef surveys, and that is where we go out and we count the quantity of any particular species in a given area, and primarily in regions that we've been conducting similar surveys. I know a couple of years back, there was a few of you that went out and did one of those survey dives at Sunset House with me. And there's 200 to 250 instances of staghorn coral with a whole bunch of patches that 3 years previous, there was like 4 or 5. This year we counted 300 and kind of just said, well, there's like 46 big areas of coral cover, about 10 foot by 10 foot as a minimum size. When we go through and do our next count, all the recently settled coral larvae are going to be too small for us to find in any reasonable manner. It would require specialized equipment and probably night dives and dealing with luminescence to even see them. But all the corals that have survived from last year's spawning, they should be visible. They should be a year old. And not just that they're a year old and they're roughly the size of my hand, but that they've persisted for an entire year. And so we can mark them down confident that whatever process and threats they faced, they've been able to overcome them. And then they should, in theory, survive into next year and onto the next year. So our maps then are updated to reflect the corals that we've already found, the corals that we just recently found, any new corals we find this year, and then next year, and then the year after that. So instead of it being a whole bunch of different maps, it's one map and then another map and then the same map with different stuff added onto it. And it shows that development of the individual coral species we're working with. And we've implemented this on a large scale. Right now, our entire western coastline is under treatment in this manner. All of the sites were put out back last year in July. So even if it was too stressful for them to move last year, and they either did polyp, stress type spawn or anything where they weren't solidly recruiting onto the local reef, they absolutely should have recruited onto the reef this year. And we'll find out when we surveys all along the west side whether or not we're finding 40 odd corals in that survey zone downstream from our nurseries, or if we're finding three or four. It's a pretty stark contrast.
Right. So that recruitment you mean is the recruitment of new settlers or new baby corals that are coming off of the corals that you guys put out there on the, are you calling them, what do you call the corals that you put on? Would you, are those just the coral trees to you, or what are you calling them?
The coral spawning stations are basically just the nursery structures that we have, similar to any of the nursery structures used all around the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. The idea that we lean into with them is we take 2 to 4 genetics, or they're referred to as genotypes, of each particular species on each one of the structures. So there'll be branches going sideways and then lengthwise and all the pieces hanging off. One entire branch or maybe a second row will all be one genetic. The next 2 rows down will be from another coral structure of the same species, and then room for a 3rd or sometimes even 4th genetic on that particular structure. And the idea there is to create as much genetic diversity for the corals to be able to do a mass spawning event and fertilize because of the close proximity of the same species but different genetics. So when they do spawn, those gametes, that they don't have to, they boom, and then it fertilizes right away. We put one structure in a few places because we ran out of anchors, but the idea is to put at least 2 structures at each one of our spawning sites, which are miniature nurseries spaced roughly 1,000 to 1,500 meters apart. And the idea is the coral, when it spawns, can transmit up to 2 kilometers. And we're not going that far. We're putting something right around half that distance, or maybe slightly past half that distance, because in our own surveys, we found that 500 to 600 meters is a main area of the coral retention. And we can use that area of intense coral saturation from each annual spawning to not only build an abundance of coral back onto the reef, which we're now seeing at year 3, where we just have big parts of the reef that are just covered with staghorn. They're still young, and they'll get bigger, but the reef is now covered with it instead of it doesn't exist at all. But it also is the result of sexual propagation instead of fragmentation. And what that allows us to do is take 3 or 4 genetics, allow that to spawn over the course of 3 to 5 years, and put 300 to 1,000 unique genetics, all related to those parent corals, but a whole lot of new genetics out onto the reef that in later years, 3 to 5 years down the road from when they first settle and start growing, they can help rebuild that required gene pool, that stability that allows a population to develop appropriately and doesn't end up with genetic bottlenecks. Basic rule of thumb is you want to have about 10 to 15 genetics as a minimum for the acroporid type species to have sufficient diversity spread across a several kilometer region so that you can get a healthy population of those corals forming back up.
Right. And why would you say the genetic diversity is so important right now for those corals along the reef?
We face a number of problems for our coral reefs. Some of them are very much driven by things that we do and ways that we've done business and activities for decades, and it's going to require a change on our own part. Some of those changes come from the natural world, and oftentimes in the form of diseases, predators, just bleaching events. And in those instances, if a coral is susceptible to a particular disease, statistically in the 80s, roughly 5 to 6% of the Acropora were resistant to the diseases that wiped most of the coral or Acropora species out in the Caribbean in the 80s and 90s. Most of our corals are survivors from that 5 to 6%, but new diseases are being found all the time that can be absolute chainsaw wielding madmen. And we're dealing with one right now in the form of stony coral tissue loss disease. Thank God it doesn't affect our corals, but it's killing everything else out there. And having that genetic diversity means, yeah, this coral will die from it. Its close sibling will die from it. But these three here, they're not particularly wiped out by it. It might weaken them, but these three will continue to survive. And it's a numbers game at the end of the day. If it kills 60% or 90% or 100% of a certain species of coral, that could be a game over.
What species are you seeing impacted the most by tissue loss?
Right now, we have the stony coral tissue loss disease moved into the Cayman Islands. It is a very frustrating scenario to deal with because of the large number of unknowns. Right now, essentially every species of stony coral, except for three that we're aware of, suffer pretty much 90% or higher fatality from it. Acropora cervicornis, which is the staghorn I work with, Acropora palmata, which is the elk horn, and then Possilophora fusillara, which is a little, or Possilophora digitata, which is a little purple Possilophora that you see in the shallows sometimes, little kind of finger coral. That's it. Everything else is affected by it.
Oh, I didn't know that Possilophora wasn't.
It just happens to be, or excuse me, Porites digitata, Porites.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but that's it. Every other stony coral is susceptible to it, and some of them, a lot of the maize grains, anything that would almost be like a large polyp stony, it's a game ender for them.
What, so are those like, what would some of the common names for those species be? Just
The mountainous star coral.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
The knob star coral, any of the star coral species.
And those
all
are kind of
maize brains. All the there's about three or four various maize brains, and each one of them are pretty much first round recruits that pass out in about 5 to 6 days. It can spread an inch to two across the colony. So something, you know, the size of a soccer ball cut in half is wiped out in 5 days. It's catastrophic for the region there.
I've seen some videos on the internet, and I'm of like a green liquid or something that's sometimes sprayed onto the corals. Do you know what's kind of the treatment right now for that?
Right now, what we are doing through the Department of Environment, because they're the ones that are administering all of this, is there is an antibiotic paste, which is basically just, you know, polysporin mixed with a little bit of paste to give it the consistency of a toothpaste. And we go out there with these big syringes packed full of the stuff. And when you find a piece of coral and it's all obviously damaged, we apply it along the edge where the dead versus surviving coral is and kind of tamp it down in and smooth it in. And what we're finding is that is proving largely successful in preventing the current spread of that particular infection of the stony coral tissue loss disease. However, it doesn't prevent later infection or reinfection from a nearby coral, and then a piece comes off of it, floats over and lands not on the dead part, but on the live part. And now you're right back at square one. There is some discussion right now that it is in fact not a microbe, but in fact is a viral agent that affects the zooxanthellae algae living inside the layers of some of the coral skin. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that makes it a better scenario. If it's riding piggyback on a lot of the zooxanthellae spread throughout the water column, that may mean that we would would have to filter and strain all the different zooxanthellae, the little phytoplankton that's floating around in the water column that the corals would normally catch instead of consume to put into their skin as they do their natural shift from one season to the next to the next. It's a extremely dynamic population of algae that lives in the layers of those coral skin. I know in home aquariums, we oftentimes get lucky where we don't have to worry about that so much, but when you're dealing with substantial temperature shifts, with substantial light changes, even just what fish and what other animals live in the area out competing certain algaes, figuring out which ones it would even be that are infected and removing them is pretty much an impossible task. So the treatment of the coral alone is a great way to keep that coral from dying today, but there's nothing that we can do really to protect it long-term. And if it's in the water column, how long it remains there currently sits at about 7 to 8 years off the coast of Florida, and that doesn't show any sign of relenting. So it may be a permanent addition to our underwater environment, mm-hmm. which will be bad for a lot of the corals.
Right. Just one more viral infection sweeping across the planet.
Whatever the one is, it's so much more upsetting to see it in action. It's you're at the Maldives and you swim over all those fields of bleached out coral. It's gutting to see its impact in an incredibly short period of time.
Mm-hmm. And so what would you attribute to the change or the why is this virus now getting up into the Caribbean?
It could be a number of different things. The idea of global warming is often misrepresented to mean like the part that we live on is getting warmer, and that's not what most of the earth is covered in. It's the wet stuff that only a few of us get into on a regular basis. That's the part that's getting hotter, and especially in coastal areas. So it could be as simple as a half degree to 1 degree temperature shift has made that particular virus more suitable to survive. And it maybe made a specific type of algae that particular virus was predatory on for a number of years, but was never a primary algae that was being taken in by all these different corals. And now, because of the slight shifts, whatever it was competing with is now no longer dominant. In fact, this other algae that carries the virus has now become dominant, and thus it's feeding itself to all these corals and poisoning them that way. There's just so many unknowns. It's almost impossible to make an accurate prediction.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point, what we're doing here in the Cayman Islands is just about the only answer that anybody might have. That is, bunch of people with bad haircuts and sunburned skin get in the water every day or every couple of days with a syringe of this antibiotic toothpaste, and they swim around looking for any corals that are infected and just try to keep it at bay that way. Maybe things will peter out and it'll just disappear. But my experience over the last year and a half is that's not how illnesses work. So we may be stuck with this for the long term, and mm-hmm. it's probably going to be the case.
So, and I don't want to, I apologize if I'm asking too many questions about tissue loss, like stony coral tissue loss disease, because I don't expect you to be an expert on it. It's new area. I'm just wondering, does anyone know kind of where it, for us from historically, can we kind of trace back reefs that have been dealing with it in the past and then see how that affected those reefs or anything like that?
South Florida.
Okay. Well, that's a bad example.
Yeah. So you saw that happen with Florida.
Yeah.
That's the next couple of years for all the different islands.
Right.
It's way here. It's made its way to a lot of the other small Caribbean islands. Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's not like it's like a virus that was occurring in some other part of the world and it was there for a long time. This is kind of like a novel virus, like similar
pretty
to
much
COVID.
yeah.
Well, that's,
there was a funny story that it was from that there's a bacteria in there that looked just like human gut bacteria.
Oh,
and wow. That would mean it had to have come from your gut.
Right.
And Yeah. And so they were trying to blame it on sewage and all these other things. And people were like, I think that's more incidental than an actual causative. And I'm actually surprised that it's turned out that the most promising lead is that it is a virus that affects the algae. That was not the direction I was expecting it to go, for sure. But as we've examined the symptoms of it, it does make more sense, because most viruses tend to be an absolute horror show when corals are weakened during a bleaching event. And yet the stony coral tissue loss disease seems to be largely slowed down and thwarted by bleaching events, because they're spitting the algae out, maybe creating some similar sort of a reaction in the corals, a coral epicac, if you will, that would respond to that particular viral presence that would cause them to expel those algae, might be a means to allow the coral to survive and to take in different algae. I don't even know how widespread that virus is able to affect the phytoplankton in a certain area, but a lot of different options that are out there. Unfortunately, it's been 8 years and we just figured out it's a virus. So you can probably guess just how much funding has been pushed towards all of this, and just how on their own most of the researchers are trying to go through and sort all of this out and get a real answer. There's been other stuff going on, and coral kind of falls to the side sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see the kind of recovery of the, I mean, originally before, because I'm just thinking of in terms of other reefs and looking back at Florida and, you know, those dominant species like the Palmata and Cervicornis that were out there. Was that similar to the Cayman Islands? Was it mostly covered in those two, the Elkhorn, Staghorn?
Not since I've been coming here, but my wife's family has been coming here since the 70s. And we were lucky enough that her father was able to get a hold of some slides from someone who had an underwater camera rig back in like 1970 something. And while it's a bunch of hilariously out of date pictures, the background scenes with the coral were just amazing. Fields of acroporas. There's one where it is everything that is framed in sight of the diver's butt and their leg. The entire ground is nothing but pillar coral.
Wow.
It is an amazing scene. And I know those were accidental parts of the image, but wow, how shocking to see all these years later.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely were covered just like that.
Yeah.
And it's a bit gutting to see those old pictures, just because of how over the top the difference is between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that long.
So most of your work is with the staghorn coral. Why not the elkhorn?
Well, because staghorn is sexy. It grows quickly. It survives rather difficult scenarios. And as a general rule, most coral programs that are working with any sort of nursery activity, especially in the Caribbean, they're almost certainly going to start with staghorn coral, because it is easy to work with. It is a visceral coral that people can look at and go, oh wow, those are doing great, look how big they are now. And they were at one point the dominant coral on most of the reefs out there, so adding them back into the environment in any amount of abundance is really going to be a benefit for the reef overall in just about any circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
The elkhorn, they're similarly dramatic growing, but not quite as fast. And they are a bit more finicky, I guess is the right word to use. They're a little bit more challenging. They require a bit more maintenance and a little bit more preparation to be able to grow them effectively. And so I know that a lot of programs, when they step into dealing with additional species, tend to struggle with the elkhorn. And in fact, I've got modified nursery structures that we'll be using during the course of this year, because our big expansion is to add more sites, but also to get the Elkhorn not only cultivated up in our nursery, but ready to distribute out to all of our existing spawning stations starting, you know, May of next year, because they do need to be part of that. We've had some in our nursery for a little over a year and a half right now, and they are definitely challenging compared to the staghorn, but with the appropriate structures, they should be pretty manageable, and they can hybridize with our staghorn bulls. And so we can end up with a third species, a hybrid called Fusillara, that can breed back in later years with our Acropora cervicornis and also the palmata, the elkhorn. And then you can get back to pure staghorn and pure elkhorn from that hybrid, mixing back with either of the parent species. It's a rather interesting kind of bridge species that we get to work with there. And I think that's going to be important to getting corals back into the shallow areas where we're not seeing recruitment right now.
Can the hybrid breed with the hybrids? Like, can hybrids?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Absolutely. It's just almost like it's a color variation between the three species. It's a growth pattern, but they are genetically similar enough that there is a lot of back and forth that they're capable of handling. And the Fusillara is a really interesting bridge species. It does allow a huge amount of playing around with the genetics and the physical structure of corals in a given area. We may find that that's necessary because corals aren't coming back and the water's near the iron shore. It's shallow, it's warm, and there is potential runoff from freshwater cisterns and septic tanks. So there's potential pollution, high water temperatures, and also storm activity that could be the reason why we're not seeing any staghorn recruitment in those areas.
The shallow areas.
I would argue that the elkhorn should be able to settle into those areas without the challenge to the storm-based activity or the heat, because they are better adapted to dealing with high-intensity waves and also warmer temperatures. If it's the pollution, we're back at square one. But if it's either of those other two issues, the elkhorn should start to move into those areas, and then by hybridization, we may find the Fusillara is able to move in there along with it. And that would allow us at subsequent years to see the staghorn breed itself back into a pure species of staghorn from the hybridized Fusillara in those same areas, but with the protection offered by the physical structure of the older elkhorn and also the Fusillara that it would be growing in and amongst. So it may be a sequence of events to get corals to move into those more challenging areas where we're not seeing recruitment. And that's a big part of what I'm hoping to observe by adding the elkhorn into our program at this point.
So what's the impacts of not having corals in the shallows?
Well, instead of being a 30 to 50 foot area with massive three-dimensional coral structure filled with fish, and acting as a nursery and home for pretty much everything that grows out on the reef, it's a flat, smooth, featureless surface. I use the example sometimes of describing a Walmart. Say there was Walmart, and there's a big field next to Walmart, with a creek running through the middle of it, and a whole bunch of trees running along the length of the creek. And people at Walmart decided what they want to do is bulldoze that field and pave over the creek and put a parking lot there with a big drain in the middle. If you saved a cutting from one of those trees, could you plant it in the middle of that field? Probably not. Cars would run it over. Mm-hmm. And then once they fix it all in, all the critters that lived in that area, do you think they'd do good? Say there was a thousand little baby chickens running around in that field and drinking the water and eating all the bugs in the grass. If you let that same thousand little baby chickens loose in the Walmart parking lot, all fenced off so they couldn't leave the area, no cars in there, and you let three or four big hungry dogs loose, and mm-hmm. they'd have such a good time, there would be no chickens left. And just a couple of, I mean, the dogs would be like, that was amazing. but eventually the dogs would starve to death also unless you provided an additional source of food.
Right.
And that's what we're seeing in those shallow areas that are just worn down flat.
Mm-hmm.
By contrast, if you put a car in each one of the parking spots in that Walmart parking lot and you let the same 1,000 chickens loose, that's like all the little baby fish with a three-dimensional structure of the coral. You let those same three dogs loose in that Walmart parking lot, they'd eat some chickens, but a bunch of those little baby chickens would survive, mm-hmm. grow up, have chickens of their own. The dogs wouldn't starve to death. They'd find enough food during the course of the next year, and the chickens would have a sustainable population, or at least they should.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to recreate, is that three-dimensional structure that allows all the fish species that are right now sorely lacking all across the reef because of that initial habitat having been removed since my wife was a kid and remembers jumping in the water there at Sunset House and having to fight her way over all the coral and getting cut up because it was, you know, a meter and a half tall and just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
They had to cut channels through it so divers could swim out to the reef without getting all shredded. It's flat, featureless, 10 foot deep. Nothing's going to survive there as a juvenile. Any predator is going to wipe them out. So by getting those corals to regrow in that area, we should be able to see fish populations return to something closer to what they were back when I was a kid. Right now, it's projected we're around 80% of the fish population is missing that should be here. That's a big part of the fish population. They're just, they don't make it through their larval stage or their childhood. There's no.
So that's like, that's like 80% based on, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, they're thinking that's how much we're losing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the fishermen blame the divers, that obviously the divers grabbed them all up, and the divers always blame the fishermen, but they didn't catch all the fish, not with a hand line.
Mm-hmm.
There's no trawlers. There's no commercial fishing right there in the shore area. And even the guys that are fishing kind of illegally, yeah, they've got a tin can with fishing line wrapped around it 10,000 times and a hook with a piece of squid, and they drop it off the side of the boat, and they sit there with the line and oh, got one, and they reel it in. You're not wiping anything out that way. I mean, don't get me wrong. They could catch a fair amount of fish that way,
mm-hmm.
but that's not wiping out fish populations.
Right.
Their habitat was destroyed and doesn't exist at all anymore. It hasn't for decades at this point.
So how does the Cayman Islands benefit? So, because I keep going in my head, there's these obvious impacts to the fisheries nearby. There's the obvious impacts of losing all of this structural diversity and the protection of the shoreline. There's all these clear impacts that we know happen when we lose all these reefs. Why don't you think, whether it's the Cayman Islands or everywhere else, why don't you think there's more attention and more money pouring into something like this that obviously has these huge economic and tangible values, but also, you know, all these recreational values and things like that?
One of the biggest challenges anybody in coral reef management, coral restoration, coral renewal, whatever you want to refer to it as, we have to admit the track record of success is pretty dismal. What's the name of the program that's been really, really successful and they made huge progress over the course of the last 10 years in Florida?
Yeah, the coral restoration? Yeah, I don't think there's any.
$1 billion into the Florida reef track last year.
Right.
They lost ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's a losing fight. They're not adjusting their techniques. They're not refocusing. And it's been 20, 30 years at this point of not really making the change that everybody wants to see. And
right.
I mean, at the end of the day, they're trying to push water uphill with a net. It's an almost impossible task that is being set out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, I think there's a degree of disenchantment on the part of government agencies that are just like, yeah, how about you actually get something there? And then maybe we'll sit there and talk. But otherwise, I mean, the tourists are still coming. There's still some fish. How bad could it be? And there is a disconnect in their own heads about how bad it actually is.
Right.
But also, I mean, would you buy a car that you knew everybody else who got one, it broke?
Right.
Kind of hard to justify spending that money. Even going to fundraising internationally to go and speak to some of the larger groups that are looking to support programs. One of the very first questions they have is, so how's it work? Show me. What are the results? Because everybody and their brother out there is promising the moon and the stars. They're not yielding the results. Years later, people look around and they're like, that was $100 million. Like, seriously, guys. Anything to show for it?
Right. And so this is diving into some really deep, hard questions. And I remember talking to one of my cousins who is he's just what would you say? He's just a hardcore businessman. He's lives in Toronto. He runs a few companies. He's very, very business minded. He doesn't understand ecology or anything like that, or restoration, blah, 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 but he still cares. But what's nice when I talk to him about this stuff sometimes is he kind of looks at it in a different lens. And one of the things he said to me, you know, we were having a beer talking about whatever, and he goes, okay, well, let's say we pull everybody into a room and we have the funds that you need. What do you need to do right now to save the coral reefs? And that question, I mean, I'm not trying to say that I'm a conservation expert. I'm definitely not. But when he asked me that question, I thought of all the different restoration techniques and all of the different ways. But then I just kept thinking, well, no, our big problem is this changing climate and the rate that it's changing and all of these different issues that are coming as a result of population and climatic changes and all this type of thing is really that root problem. And I don't know if that's something that can be fixed. I don't think it's something that can be fixed, at least in my mind. I mean, so
the sad reality is most of the causes of the challenge that coral reefs and a lot of the conservation programs are facing, at the end of the day, they come from kind of awesome stuff. I like my iPhone. I like the internet. Airplanes are pretty neat. Big ships traveling stuff all around the planet on a regular basis. I can jump in my truck and tow my boat to put it in the water and then take my boat to go do what I want, then pull it back out of the water. And if something breaks, I can go to the store here in a little tropical island and have stuff flown partway around the world so I can fix what I need to fix. We have an incredibly complex system. And a lot of it came at a cost that I don't think we were aware of when we were first setting up all this stuff, but it's becoming rather obvious now that some of this stuff has definitely got a much steeper cost than we really were bargaining for. But like in the case of the Great Barrier Reef, a huge part of the reason why the northern half of the Great Barrier Reef is in so much danger is because waters from the Coral Sea hit right at the same area, pushing in towards the main body of the continent, where the breadbasket of Australia's agricultural industry drains into a single point in the sea, picking up all that nutrient-rich water, all that water with fertilizer and runoff and everything else, and then carrying it north across the Great Barrier Reef. It starts off pretty far away, but gets closer and closer as it goes north.
Right.
That's fertilizing the reef with Miracle-Gro, for lack of a more descriptive term. And at the end of the day, I'm pretty sure Australians deserve to eat. So how do we solve a problem of that scope that's that fundamental to a community or to an entire continent?
Right. And for those that are listening that aren't really seeing the problem with that, I mean, not everybody would realize, but like in our fish tanks, for example, if we were to go and dump a whole bunch of, Acro Power, we dump the whole bottle in, right? You just have this excess of everything inside the water. And this similar with this with this pollution and runoff, the corals just don't respond well. Well, it seems like, oh, well, if you throw a bunch of fertilizer onto the grass, it'll work. But in this case, you're burning the grass type of thing.
Well, the problem is if the grass lived in the layers of your skin, those eosinophilic algae living inside the layers of the coral skin are algae at the end of the day.
Right.
They respond to those fertilizers that are running off into the water just as much as anything else. Not only is algae that grows in clumps next to a coral growing faster and larger than it normally would, but those algae living inside some of those corals are also behaving in very unusual ways that is going to put the coral into that stress response and eject those out, which causes bleaching events, which puts the coral in a weakened state. It's not hurt, but now its primary food supply has been removed. And now it has to catch new algae and pull those back in. But if they're acting funny because of that change in the amount of nitrate in the water from that fertilizer, they may decide that's food and not something to put in the layers of their skin to add to their photosynthetic process. And so,
right,
how do we get around that? There's an incredibly complex system that operates underwater around our coral reefs, and very small shifts can have very long reaching aftershocks. And you're right. How are we addressing those greater long-term problems? From what I've observed, I don't think the Florida reef system was ever savable from an objective point of view in the first place. It's too shallow. It gets hit by too many storms. There's too much industrialization there. There's too much activity. Like the hard pan area just off our shore, it may have been covered in coral at one point, but because of all those factors, that's been worn down smooth, and there are very few places left with any amount of robust coral reef structure, much less abundant coral life on that structure. One of the comments I heard from a researcher from Florida is like, wow, you guys have a lot of reef structure here. Like, this is amazing, because they don't have that even anymore. It's all been eroded down and flat.
Right.
How are we going to get around that? Even the option I have to try to get corals to survive past 50 to 100 years involves deep water. There is no deep water in Southern Florida. You go to the Keys, good luck finding 50 foot, much less 100 to 1,000 foot. It doesn't exist. And those very real physical challenges prevent certain areas from being able to sustain much beyond where we're at right now. And I'm not seeing a really rosy future for the next 20 years either. So even places like here, we may face a further zone that corals are not able to survive in. We may find that the mini wall that we're used to diving on, it's not working anymore. We're observing for that, but it's at least a legitimate concern considering the changes the last 20 and 30 years have brought to this area. And if I do manage to get the corals into those deeper areas over the course of the next 5 to 10 years through the spawning activity that I'm doing, and I'm fortunate enough to spread this to the number of islands that I have identified that should be satisfactory for this program, that do fit all the other physical requirements for it to even work in the first place, even if we do get all of that done, it still hinges off the idea that 50 to 100 years down the road, sooner or later, got to get this whole scenario turned around. The corals can't live in the water in that shallow area right now. Mm-hmm. If we don't change things in 50 to 100 years, doesn't matter if we save it that long, it's just going to die off then.
Are you noticing more recruitment in the deeper water?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. The problem, though, is I can't put divers out there. 100 foot is great to visit and go click, click, click. We got a whole handful of them.
Right.
But I can't send people out there with hammers and tools and equipment to stick around for 30 minutes at a time.
Yeah,
I'd have decompression injuries and bent divers, and that's a huge safety concern. So instead, we're working and observing as the corals spawn in our nurseries. It's kind of a cone of dispersion. Then going up into the shallows, which again, we've commented on, and it's very, very frustrating. lots in that central area, the mini wall and any little fingers that stick out from the mini wall out to the main edge of the island. The main edge of the island is only about 60 foot deep to 80 foot deep, depending on where you're at around the island. But it drops off over 1,000 foot. I mean, we're just up on the very tippy top. There's a whole lot of drop off all around the island.
Mm-hmm.
That edge, you get down 80, 100 foot, down to about 150, maybe close to 200, about 180. Sunlight still penetrates there. We have really good water quality. It's exposed to thousands of hundreds of trillions of gallons of water. I mean, the whole sea right there. It helps regulate temperature, helps prevent sedimentation because it's on a vertical wall. Different reef zones, so we don't have the same predators and the problems that we face with some of the shallow water predators that we're dealing with right now. Because of the vertical wall, we're hoping that that mitigates some of the disease factors that can affect shallow water corals that are sitting in a flat zone to get picked up and moved, and then moved. They get out to the edge, it just drops off, and then less exposure overall. But what we can't account for is over time, the eventual accumulation of carbon into the water. Over time, carbon moving into water, it needs something to bond to. It doesn't just go into water and just floats around. It either bonds to oxygen, or if you're in a reef type environment, it'll often bond to calcium. You'll end up with calcium carbonate, the very skeleton of the coral. But if there's not sufficient oxygen or calcium for that to bond to, one of the only options left for carbon is that it will bond to itself. And that forms carbonic acid. Mm-hmm. And the acidification of the ocean, if you will, is a kind of glorified version of that very simple transaction. The more of that that happens, the further our pH shifts off the 8.4, 8.2 norm that it's supposed to be at. Once it reaches a certain point where it begins being able to break down that calcium carbonate, we may find that the corals themselves are no longer able to form their calcium carbonate bodies. We may find that the physical structures are melting. We may find that many of these coral-based islands are finding that their outer edges are beginning to fizzle away one bubble at a time. It's a rather intimidating reality and prospect there, but these islands are made out of just hundreds of, well, a couple million years of coral grown one on top of the next, on top of the next. 1,000 foot tall, and they're subject to all the same physical weaknesses that calcium carbonate structures are subjected to. So we have to get ahead of that carbon. We have to get ahead of that rising temperature. We have to curb those sort of shifts in our watery environment, because it may be the only factor that we can't account for in long-term preservation of these corals.
Right, and you're and the excess carbon is thinking the ocean of a as a carbon sink is the excess CO2 in the air is what's kind of causing this acidification in the water.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then so how it's funny because I've learned about these things 100 times, right? And then the way that you describe them and the way you kind of break them down on the way that they're actively happening around the Cayman Islands, it's just, it makes it so unbelievably real. Yeah. And that's kind of, so that was my other kind of big question. I mean, we're getting close to the end here, and I know we've talked about a lot of really dark circumstances. How do you remain optimistic, and how do you think that the work that you're doing and the work that others are doing around the Caribbean is something to keep getting up in the morning and making this fight?
What I'm doing is doing exactly what, actually a little bit more than what I was ever hoping it would. It works. Mm-hmm. I can confidently sit down with people, show them what I've done, and they go, yeah, that's what we were talking about. Like it's going on. I talked to other researchers about our coral recruitment, and they can't believe that we're having it on a regional scale, that we have sites that we've been studying for several years now with dramatic, huge population shifts. Works. And right now, I am some random guy with a very unique set of skills in some far-flung corner of the planet with no plan to have done this whatsoever. And I get to use these very unusual skills to help preserve corals that are like 97% extinct right now. Like in the next 10, 20 years, we're done. I get to help prevent that. That is extremely exciting. Because they're going to go extinct for all the reasons we just talked about. It's 97% of the way done, like it's almost over. I can stop these little clusters of coral from disappearing forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I put together a plan that studies other activities. It studies dispersion of pelagic species. So I have a really good program set up for what islands I want to bring this program to next. Coronavirus threw me for a loop. I was supposed to have been out speaking at conventions and bringing this to a larger audience. I was supposed to be at the Florida event on December 15th to help bring this to a bunch of the coral restoration programs. And that one got canceled too. That is beside the point. It doesn't change the fact that what this is works, and it's easy, and it's straightforward, and I'm confident I will have the opportunity to bring this to that larger group of islands, and I won't see the end results of everything, but that's a pretty satisfying realization. If it didn't work, I'd probably just say, yeah, it does.
Yeah. I think there's two points I wanted to make. And we always try and tie this back to the aquarium hobby to make it palatable for our listeners and relatable. And a lot of what Aaron just described in terms of pH and carbon and all that stuff, generally the aquarium hobby should be able to relate that to our reef tanks. You know, your CO2 goes up in your house, your pH drops. Like, it's all the same thing, everybody. So
nighttime versus understand, daytime swings.
Yeah. Understand what's going on in your house. That's what's going on in the ocean. So absorb that knowledge that you already have and start getting it out there. Tell people, like, do something about this. Mm-hmm. The other part that I think is interesting is there's, while I like to believe that all these groups are well-intentioned, sometimes you need to let go of an idea. If it's not working, are you doing it for the right reason, or are you doing it to continue the cause of your corporation? And I think that's a question that people need to start asking themselves. What is your reason? Is this working, or could you be looking around and talking to other people and finding another way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, I mean, and to your point about the Aquarius, you know, even we always talk too about how can your normal Aquarius, you know, one nice thing about being in the aquarium hobby is that not every single person, you know, if you go into research, everybody's been, for the most part, it's been trained. They all kind of think about things in a certain way. But in the aquarium hobby, we've got electricians, we've got plumbers, we've got kindergarten teachers. We got every single type of person that is become their own kind of citizen scientist and trying to figure things out in their own little reef. And they look at it, everything from a different perspective. And when something gets said like this, like we're thinking, oh yeah, when the CO2 in my house goes up, I got to open a window so that I can get the air out of here so that the pH comes in, or I plumb my skimmer into the outdoors, or I put a CO2 scrubber onto my skimmer, like all these different ideas that pop into people's heads on how we treat these systems. Of course, not all of these, like none of the ideas that I just gave out are going to be something that can be applied onto wild reefs, but that's how these ideas can come out of looking at things from a different perspective. And maybe that's right. A way that people can help.
because when you talk about these things on a global scale, people sort of glaze over. They don't really understand, but it's happening in your living room if you're an Aquarius. So pay attention to that and understand it's not just because it's an aquarium. This is how biology works. Even when you were discussing stony tissue coral loss, we would probably think of that as RTN in our aquarium, and it's all the same reasons.
Very similar.
They're looking at pathogens, they're looking at temperature shifts, all these things. It's happening in your tank, so it's not a different scenario. And I think that's why we're trying to get hobbyists to latch on and understand this. What's going on in your tank is on a world level, and you need to do your part and try and elicit change.
Awareness is very important, but beyond that, realistic goals are an incredibly critical part of any major problem like this. I think a lot of people misunderstand and have accepted the idea that personal recycling or personal individual accountability is the way forward to change. And I don't know if that's a fair or reasonable solution for most people. If you do understand what's happening, your first step as an adult should be to speak to someone in your local government, someone who represents you, who can help create the changes at a government, at a legal level, that prevents the importation or the production of the items that are most egregious. There's going to have to be some back and forth. But unless you go to those actual primary sources, the mass production, the transportation, and the distribution of all these different things that individually add up to very large problems are never going to stop. We're going to get Band-Aid fixes. We're going to get really nice propaganda speeches from various companies. We won't see the long-term end result changes that we need to have occur if we just rely on the goodwill of everybody at Conglomo, because Conglomo at the end of the day is trying to make money and they're worried about everything else afterwards. Your representatives in government are the people that are supposed to represent you and your best interests. So you need to speak with them and create a dialogue that lets them know what is important, what things you see as real problems, because until we start doing that on a large scale, we won't see the changes that need to occur. And banning straws or reef-safe sunscreen was a great act in civil, kind of getting everybody organized to play that out, and there you did it. But a straw is really the solution. Is reef-safe sunscreen really fixing the greater global problems of congestion and smog and carbon and all the other different issues that are being faced? It's probably going to require people who understand those industries that are going to sit down at a table and kind of walk people through it, because we need to figure out what the real egregious issues are and get those fixed.
Yeah. I think the straws and all that sort of thing, it's just a way to get people talking and prove that you can do something and then understand the issue, and hopefully it goes forward. And I think they did prove that they can get people to listen, but we need to take it that next step.
And now it's time to ask for adult things when we sit down with those legislators.
All right. Well,
that's hard. So yeah, not my job to do. I'm fixing the coral. Y'all can handle the rest.
It's just such a huge issue. And it's so hard sometimes to wrap your head around these different things. And it totally is one of those things where it's like, you start to kind of break down in your own head. Like, is this really something that we can do? Does any of this really matter? And sometimes I think those little small things, like, you know, maybe if we can bring everybody together, agree on straws, hopefully that's the gateway drug to start, you know, educating people that there are some big issues out there, you know, bigger issues that are way more important than the next generation iPhone or the next piece of crap that we have. And I'm not saying that people don't need their crap. Everybody needs their crap. I have lots of crap too.
Is awesome.
Yeah. But, you know, man, go dive a coral reef and see what it does to your well-being. It's a lot it's a lot better for you. that's kind of the note that I mean, after COVID, you know, being kind of locked down in Ontario, it's I'm ready to get out there and dive. I don't know about you, Ian.
Oh, I'm supposed to have been down there three or four times already by now.
But... Oh yeah, it's yeah. We're ready. Trust me. What a mess.
But as always, it is our absolute pleasure to have you here, and we agree with you. I agree with you. I know Ian does too. And we believe in your mission, and we're here to help in any way we can. And for everyone who listens to our show, you know how much we love Cayman Eco Divers and that we want to support you guys. So if there's a, you know, we put out all our shout outs all the time about the Cayman Eco Divers. At the end of this episode, you'll hear the blurb where we talk about how you can support them. So pay attention to all the blurbs and you know, everything helps. So thanks again.
In terms of all of that, there's a lot of things in the works that you guys will hear about in the coming months as well to make that even easier. So stay tuned.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the support that we have received from all of you over the course of the last couple of years. It is extremely encouraging to have people elsewhere who are like, keep going, dude, you're doing all right. You can do this, because it is discouraging sometimes. So sure. It is nice to hear people saying, hey, keep going, this is doing good. I mean, mm-hmm. I know it's working, but yeah, it still can be kind of discouraging sometimes. Oh, and it really does mean a lot to me and to Brittany as well.
Right on. All right. Till next time. Thanks again, Aaron.
Awesome. Thanks, Aaron. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the For the Reef podcast. As always, you can reach us at ForTheReefPodcast@gmail.com or via our websites, ForTheReef.com or SustainableMarineCanada.ca. If you would like to get involved and help the reef restoration efforts, check out our friends at CaymanEcoDivers.com. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please hit subscribe and join us for the next episode coming soon.